Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, Conditions on State-Funded Association Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On June 28, 2010, the Supreme Court announced its decision in Christian Legal Society v. Martinez. The question in this case was whether a public university's law school may deny funding and other benefits to a religious student organization because the organization refuses to abide by a non-discrimination policy that would prevent it from requiring its officers and voting members to agree with its core beliefs, including beliefs concerning homosexual conduct. In a 5-4 opinion delivered by Justice Ginsburg, the court held that the petitioner, the Hastings Christian Legal Society chapter, was bound by its stipulation that Hastings' policy required student organizations to admit all comers in order to participate in the Registered Student Organization program. The court further ruled that this policy was a reasonable, viewpoint-neutral condition on access to a limited public forum consistent with the First Amendment. To discuss the case, we have University of Chicago Law School and New York University Law School Professor Richard A. Epstein, who was counsel of record on a brief submitted by the Cato Institute in support of the petitioner. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Professor Epstein.
Hi, this is Richard Epstein, speaking from the University of Chicago Law School, and I'm talking now about a case involving the Christian Legal Society chapter of the University of California Hastings School of Law against Martinez, who is the dean of the Hastings School of Law. And the question here is not the culmination, but at least the latest stage in an ongoing battle between the Christian Legal Society, which is essentially a small, somewhat embattled group of fundamentalist Christians who would like to be able to use email facilities, meeting rooms, and get travel allowances like all the other groups that wish to be registered student organizations at Hastings. And Hastings, in effect, has decided that it would not be prepared to extend to this group all of the privileges that are given to other organizations. And one of the first questions which preoccupied the court was, why was it that it had taken that particular stance? If you actually go back and look at the long transcript, it turns out that in this particular case, there were two policies at play. One of the policies was one which essentially announced, in effect, that any group was not allowed to discriminate against any person on the grounds of its sexual orientation or religious beliefs. And this essentially is something which would doom the Christian Legal Society on a targeted basis, because their principles say that you have to believe essentially about sexual intercourse only within the framework of marriage, and you have to believe that gay relationships is to some extent something that you're not prepared to practice and that they're condemned by the Bible. And so you would be engaging in various forms of prohibited discrimination. But there's a second policy that was stated at Hastings Law School, which was somewhat more general, probably a little bit more bizarre in the eyes of most people, and what it said, in effect, that all groups on campus had to accept all comers into their membership, whether or not they agreed to the principles involved. And so the Jewish groups must admit Christians, the Democratic groups must admit Republicans, and so forth. It's a kind of a bizarro world, because if you look within the framework of the Hastings University Law School, they sort of adopt a rule that no one can have preconditions to memberships, when every organized club which exists outside the university framework generally requires that there be some affinity of belief and organization for the way in which you start to deal with a problem. So you have these two policies. One is the sort of religion-specific policy, and the other is the general take-all-comers rule. And the question is, which particular policy ought to be involved in examining this case? And there are two ways to look at this. The first way is to kind of go back, as did the dissenters like Justice Alito, and give a close analysis of the various interactions, and to come to the conclusion that there was a huge amount of concern over the religious orientation of the CLS, and so therefore you have invidious discrimination that should give rise to all sorts of attention under the First Amendment protections, first of religion and then of speech. It doesn't, for these purposes, to my view, matter a whole lot which one you do. But on the other hand, the other policy that all groups have to take all comers may be bizarre in terms of its, shall we say, operational significance, but nobody could turn around and say, aha, that's a group which is targeted with respect to religious organizations. And what happened is Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg begins her opinion not with a stirring declaration of the permanent principles of constitutional law, but rather on exactly the opposite tack. She looks back and finds in the record a stipulation which said, in effect, that this case is decided under the all-comers policy of the Hastings Law School. And then she cites a bunch of procedural treatises, all of which say that once you have a stipulation on an admitted fact, you can't go beyond the stipulation and see what the actual record looked like. It's kind of a form of finality or res judicata within the framework of a particular case. So the strongest practical argument that was available, in fact, for the CLS was basically denuded because of this procedural stipulation. A question is, how much difference does it make and why? Now, the first question that one has to understand in virtually all of these cases is no matter which policy you're dealing with an institution which necessarily has to have at least some right to admit or exclude in order to be able to function at all. This is not even a case like the highways where everybody could come on subject to crowding restraints, but you cannot simply run a law school on the grounds that everybody who applies for the faculty is guaranteed a position and anyone who shows up the door has to be admitted as a student. What you have to do is therefore have some ability to exclude in order to be able to operate, and this is as true for a public institution as it is for a private institution. And so the question then is, what additional burdens are going to be placed on an institution by virtue of the fact that it is funded by public tax dollars, not by private institutions? Well, at the first cut, there's a very significant difference. There is no question to my mind, as a kind of a good card-carrying libertarian on this issue, that if we had a situation here in which Hastings was a completely private law school, put aside all the complications for charitable deductions and the stuff, and it decided that it didn't want to admit Christian law students because of their religious beliefs, that would be perfectly okay by me, putting aside the anti-discrimination laws, which in general I think to be a mistake, because what happens is they could form other institutions with exclusive or general rules, and essentially what will happen is these various private institutions in competition with one another will develop market niches so virtually anybody with any taste will be able to find at least some place which will be able to do the kinds of things that he wants. So that in the face of competition, I don't care the way in which individual places act. But when you're dealing with a public institution, one of the things you have to remember is that it's the Christian Legal Foundation which is funding this and its members along with everybody else, and one is very leery about saying about publicly funded organizations that they could turn to some portion of the public and say, hey, you guys can't come at all. So I take it, it would be regarded as a very serious situation if, in fact, the Christian legal students who believed in this stuff were told, hey, you can't get into the Hastings Law School at all. And nobody wanted to put forward that position. So that the school, essentially, everybody agreed, had control over admissions to the students, but it could not discriminate on sort of religious grounds in letting them in, and it could not run a faculty policy which said in so many words, we will not hire Christian legal students or faculty members to our place. What they could do, of course, is to have a whole variety of criterion to decide whom you want in and whom you want out. What makes this case a little bit trickier is that we now have a situation in which people are not trying to get onto the faculty or into the student body. What they're trying to do is to use school rooms for their group activities when classes are not in session, use their emails, use the identification boards, and so forth. And Hastings said you can't do that. I think it's pretty much agreed that if they had targeted only religious organizations, there would have been a very serious problem in this case. It's quite clear that if you had direct regulation of a private group, which said to the Christian Legal Foundation type source, society type, you can't even form an organization because of your beliefs, everybody would regard that as a violation of your constitutional protections of both religious and speech association. The issue is whether or not when you want to come into the institution, we can tell you, hey, if you want to get the benefits of our education, you have to agree to our policies just as if we're a private institution. And if, in fact, you have the explicit anti-discrimination policy relating to sexual orientation in play, this would be a kind of a viewpoint issue. And probably the way the case would have come out is that they would have said, no, you cannot tell Christian organization members that they have to sacrifice their particular religious beliefs in order to be able to obtain admissions to the law school and in order to be able to use these extra facilities. So I think that if the stipulation had gone the other way, the Supreme Court, even one which is deeply hostile in terms of its own sort of psychological orientation to what the CLS stands for, would have been hard-pressed to say that these guys were simply out of their league when they demanded this kind of equal treatment with everybody else. But once you call this a general and a neutral take-all-comers policy, which has all the same absurdities for Democrats and Republicans as it does for Christians and non-believers, it no longer looks as though it's targeted for a particular group. And the Supreme Court, in line with a lot of traditional First Amendment law, both on speech and on religion, took the position that general rules are by and large pretty much exempt from any close First Amendment scrutiny. When I wrote a brief in this particular case, I thought that they got it completely wrong, and let me see if I could explain what's missing in this particular argument. Well, the first thing I think that's missing in this particular argument is an appreciation of the fact that when the school engages in these kinds of exclusive activities, it doesn't do so as a free agent. It has to take into account the whole problem of the right-privilege distinction, or what goes under the rather exotic name of the doctrine of unconstitutional conditions. Government owns the highways. It cannot pick people out unless they agree to waive their rights to be free from unreasonable searches and seizures. Its monopoly power is too great. Same thing would happen with respect to Hastings. It couldn't say, we'll allow you to use the classrooms only if you allow the police to search you at will. There are certain positions that are so powerful that you cannot require people to waive things. So when the Supreme Court writes that this is simply a case of merely conferring a benefit on a group as opposed to inflicting a harm on them, or not conferring a benefit, inflicting a harm on them, they simply ignore this entire tradition. What happens is once you take the tradition into account and you start looking at highways, they become limited public forums so that the government, in fact, can tell people, look, you can't all demonstrate on the same day. We have time, place, and manner restrictions, but you cannot have a rule which would allow floats to be done by the gay pride group and then to deny floats for the Christian Legal Society. And in my position is, even though it's somewhat tricky to administer, exactly the same kind of argument applies with respect to the way these facilities are operated. If they're going to allow the rooms in question to be used by every other organization on campus, I think they have to be prepared to allow the Christians to use these rooms on exactly the same terms and conditions that they give to everybody else. And that, in fact, far from it being a kind of a good factor to say, hey, we didn't exclude them entirely, the operative standard here is, in fact, a standard of equal treatment. It is not a standard of some access but not complete access. This is clearly a case in which the rule has a massively disparate impact on one group, and the fact that you have this particular neutral policy doesn't conclude the entire issue, given the way which this thing takes out on the ground. So the question is, if this is the right analysis, where do we go from here? Well, to my view, the right place to do it is to simply order them to basically apply a non-discrimination rule to organizations that they don't like. And I think you'd have to be extremely wary of the kinds of arguments that were advanced by the court and by some of the concurrences, saying, in effect, look, we may not be able to punish these people, but we don't have to subsidize them. And the subsidy argument that's often made in connection with public institutions also strikes me as a giant non sequitur. This would be a subsidy of a Christian Legal Society if, in fact, the only people who had to pay the money into the school were those people who were opposed to its beliefs and they took it out. But that's not the way it works. This is a situation in which, in order to join the community, they have to put the money in along with everybody else. And if they represent a grand total of 0.5% of the total student body and they're commanding 0.5% of the total resources that the school has, that's not a subsidy at all. It's simply getting a return on your student fees that are comparable to everybody else. And in fact, if you have a situation where these people would be subject to the general taxes and not eligible to receive the benefit, there is now an implicit transfer payment and an implicit subsidy of everybody else. It's only if you assume that we, who control the institution, are completely apart from they who receive the money, that the subsidy argument that's often made in defense of the government position in Hastings is correct. So in the future, we then have to ask, how is this case going to come out? Well, I think the first thing to understand about it is that we won't see this case again. If somebody is going to try and challenge the way in which they are treated by a state institution, they are going to try to make the more focused, targeted challenge. They're going to basically try and figure out a way to show that either in the statement of the policy or in its application, they were singled out for treatment different from all other groups. Because the general facial challenges that were exist in this case are going to be extremely hard to come by. And, you know, that leaves open the question is what's going to happen when you start going back to Hastings Law School and you have a repetition where there's another application of this. I mean, if they're just going to apply their same general anti-discrimination rule, maybe they'll be all right. But if they start to engage in practices which you could get on the record in which they're being harder to these people than they were to other type groups, then, in effect, you won't see the stipulation that this was a neutral administration of a neutral statute. What you'll do is you'll see a case in which somebody says the statute is facially neutral, but there's been a disparate application and treatment of it. And look, these claims are very familiar. When you start doing anti-discrimination law, for example, in employment, all the time people say, oh, you've got a facially neutral policy, but when you came to treating your black and your white applicants, you favored one group over the other. Or in some cases, you'll say you've got a perfectly neutral policy and you applied it neutrally, but it has a disparate impact upon groups. So I think, in effect, that since so much of this case, when you go back and you look at the underlying record, was basically driven by massive suspicion and hostility between the two groups, the issue of disparate treatment under a facially neutral statute will be very much with us in the future. So we may not have heard the last of this particular case. In my own view, though, I wish they had put an end to this thing by simply adopting a rule which says that every public institution in search of diversity has to allow organizations that don't basically agree with its view of diversity, i.e. organizations that are exclusive. The level of variation that you will get in groups is far greater if each voluntary group can figure out the way in which it works. And associational freedom we've widely recognized to be an extremely important value in political situations and in religious situations. And if the courts in general have taken the position that you cannot take to a kind of a religious organization on matters of religious practice and belief an anti-discrimination norm, absent the power to exclude somebody from a public institution, I don't think that balance ought to change because you're now dealing with a situation where the question is whether or not they could get into the rooms after hours in Hastings as opposed to being on a public street, as opposed to being in their own private homes. I think the theory of limited government runs all the way down, and the doctrine of unconstitutional conditions is designed to say that there are real restraints on government when it acts as a proprietor, which are very similar to those when it acts as a regulator. This is a view which is followed in some areas in the Supreme Court, but not in others, and it's the erratic nature of the doctrine and the opportunistic nature of the decisions that leaves me so uneasy with the case.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUS Cast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.